Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular people. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to give you some insights into two portions of trials, opening statements and closing arguments. We're going to give you a prosecutor's view, a defense attorney's view, and we're going to give you a view from the bench, a judge's view. With some important trials underway and upcoming, this might really help you in following the in-court procedures just a little better. Judge, I've been looking forward to this one because this one's fun in the sense that we come at it from a little different perspectives. And so it's going to be fun to hear how you prepared. Let's start off, though, with a quick definition that maybe you and I can agree on. I get really perturbed when I read in news media and hear on television people talking about opening arguments. There are two things, opening statements and closing arguments.
Indeed.
These are times where the attorneys for both sides can speak directly to the jury. It's not an opening argument. It's an opening statement. Opening statements basically provide a roadmap, a guideline of what the evidence is going to be. And at the end, a closing argument summarizes that evidence and then makes arguments of why the jury should go one way or the other in a particular case. Those quick and dirty definitions?
They work.
Okay. All right. So let's start off with an opening statement. How did you, as a prosecutor, determine how you were going to structure an opening statement?
Well, so that our listeners understand, generally the process for delivering opening statements, and I know there are some courts that do it differently, but normally the prosecutor, and I knew I would speak first, normally the prosecutor is permitted to speak first unless they waive or they give up their right to have an opening statement, which it wasn't terribly uncommon when I was a jurist, but it was absolutely unheard of for me as a prosecutor because the cases I handled were all extraordinarily similar. I mean, extraordinarily serious. And so when I was preparing to structure my opening statement, it requires an excellent command of the facts. Now, unlike some of the pointers we might provide today for either those who are attorneys or those of you who elect to represent yourselves, that's called pro se representation. It's just Latin for on my own behalf, pro se.
Oh, you are the Latin specialist, I'll tell you.
Pro se meaning for me or on my own behalf. What I would say is making sure that your opening statement demonstrates your clear, unadulterated command of all of the facts of the case, good and bad. I never wrote an opening statement. I don't know that I've ever really written a closing argument. I had a trial notebook that contained all of the information, evidence, details, and the flow of the trial as I believed it would unfold, but I never wrote an opening statement. And maybe that's because as a preacher's kid, I grew up memorizing Easter speeches. So I never had a chance to stand there and like read a piece of paper in front of audiences. I always just had to know it. And so I've taken that with me throughout my entire career, and especially, again, as a litigator. But I was also, you know, at the risk of sounding slightly self-absorbed, I was just damn good at it. So being able to stand there, and I like to begin by finding a common theme. So something that was that I would always do or often do is I would tell either jurors, if it was a jury trial, or I would tell the judge, you know, well, let me tell you a story. And this isn't some fabled story. These are all facts, but I'm going to tell you the facts of this story as they have unfolded. And I'm throughout the process of laying out or outlining the story or the theme of this case, I would also make sure that I interlaced or interspersed important highlighted details that I knew were going to come out one way or another. So if you have a witness that you know is going to testify to something, or if you have a piece of evidence that you know the court is going to see or the jurors are going to see or something, I make sure that I tell them that up front so that they had few surprises. And yes, as a prosecutor, I often had victims who were, I'll just tell you, they were not getting good behavior awards. And so it was important to also, as part of this story, explain to my audience, whomever it was, that, hey, listen, you know, we got to manage our expectations for the actors in this play. You know, a friend of mine who's now a judge, she taught me this saying, and I suppose it was an old saying, but he would say, you know, plays cast in hell have few angels trying out for the parts. And so it wasn't uncommon for me to have, you know, a couple actors in my story who might as well had been doing their readings in hell, because they were surely not angelic. But you deserve to know that, because I just didn't believe. I thought, first of all, it was my best opportunity to develop a rapport, especially with the jury, is to be honest, to tell them what they're going to expect to hear, to be truthful, good, bad, or otherwise, but also to bring them back to the reason why we would be here. And I'll tell you my favorite line for closing arguments when we get there, because whatever the thematic reference is in the opening statement, which lays out, kind of frames the case, kind of gives them the contours of, oh, that's what I'm going to be looking for. Oh, I'm going to hear this. Oh, this is what their theory is. Oh, this is where they're going with this case. I needed to be able to refer back to that and to keep my promise by the time I got to the closing argument, which we'll talk about later. But what I wanted to do is, when I set up the framing and the thematic references to this, I also make a few promises. And I'd make promises of things that I believed or I knew they were going to hear, things they were going to see, how we were going to be able to place certain things in a certain pattern so that they could make sense of the facts and apply that to the law and making the decision we'd asked them to make. But I wanted to be able to do that up front. I wanted to be able to produce that in the middle with the testimony and evidence. And I wanted to be able to remind them in the end.
I'm chuckling because you were talking about promises. And as a defense attorney, I would remind the jury constantly of promises not fulfilled.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure I would certainly want to make some promises.
from a defense standpoint, and let's talk about criminal cases, because that's what people are most interested in. I think the Karen Reed case going on up here in Massachusetts, also the Sean Combs case.
The Puff Daddy case, yes. They're doing voir dire today, folks. And if you haven't already, check out our previous podcast on voir dire.
Yep, and that case is going to have opening statements here within the next week or so, I would imagine. So we wanted to give you this so that you could sort of use it as a guide to what you're hearing. As a defense attorney, defense attorneys have an option of waiving oral argument or oral opening statement, waiving opening statement at the time after the prosecution is finished, and instead giving an opening statement at the beginning of the defense case. Now, some attorneys do that routinely. I didn't, because I would not want the prosecution to have their side, their narrative in the jury's mind without me putting forth a counter narrative. Now, I always viewed opening statements as movie trailers, or in the old days, we used to call them previews. You know, basically what this case is going to be about, what is going to be proven, what is not going to be proven. And that's the key for the defense, what's not going to be proven. Now, this gets into a judge position, so I want you to put your judge hat on for a minute, Judge Gale. Defense attorneys often, in opening statement, start commenting on the prosecution's opening statement, saying what the prosecution can't prove. And that walks a fine line between what you say you're going to present and argument against what the other side is going to present. Is that something you confronted often as a judge?
I did, but I will tell you, I really try to remain somewhat neutral unless it brazenly or blatantly crossed the line. And the reason is because I genuinely believe the prosecution, as a judge, the prosecution has an obligation to protect its own case. And if that, now here's what I always learned and thought and felt, that, you know, objections during opening statements were tacky. I felt like they were tacky and unprofessional, and sometimes they would be done strategically to throw the attorney off or to throw the party off if they were pro se doing their own.
If somebody was on a roll, sometimes I would do it just to break rhythm.
Break their rhythm, and so that they would have to respond and they would have
so they'd not get back to that key point that they were just about to make.
Yes, and they'd have to start over, and you know, only the most skilled could kind of pick up where they left off really easily, or to kind of rewind a few seconds and say, as I was saying, this is, you know, X, Y, and Z. Most of the time, that strategy really works, is even if you know the objection is baseless and meritless and is going to be overruled, you still make it because, goodness gracious, you're leaning in to the opening statement. Yeah. You're paying too much attention. You're just, you know, this is becoming a little too compelling. And so as to, again, to break the concentration, the stride, the delivery. And that's the other thing, is it's one thing to have a really well-crafted opening statement, but it's another thing to have a very well-crafted, stunningly and beautifully delivered opening statement or closing argument delivered by somebody with charisma and an ability to capture the audience. Because otherwise, it's just words on paper, right? They could be really nice words. But oh my gosh, if you can couple the framing of this case, if you can have folks leaning in from the time you say your name, and as you all but literally take their hands and walk them through this case, if you can have that happen, then yeah, you're going to get somebody to object in the middle of your opening. You're going to deal with that. But then you're also going to have to deal with the fact that this person has potentially a jury or a judge kind of eaten out of the palm of their hands, and it makes your job harder.
I never wrote out, like you, I never wrote out an opening statement. I've never read an opening statement or a closing argument. I just think that's tacky. It's like watching President Trump read off the teleprompter. It's,
you know, well, lots of them did it. President Obama read off of teleprompters too. So, and certainly, you know, President Biden.
I don't care. What I tried to do as a defense attorney was to get the jury to like me. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, to trust me, because most of the time, my client was not a sympathetic character, was not somebody that the jury was going to like inherently.
Plays cast in hell.
They had to like me, and they had to trust me so that I could transfer that to my client. And part of opening statement is, as much as from a defense point of view, from as much as possible, to make my client a sympathetic character, if at all possible. Mm-hmm. Because the jury thinks the person's guilty just because they're sitting there, regardless what they've said in voir dire. So I have to try to make that person a more sympathetic character, make that person human, make that person real, make that person identifiable to the jury. And you do that through opening statement. You know, there's no formula on how to do that. But you, just as prosecutors make victims of crime real to a jury, I have to make my defendant real and as identifiable as possible to a jury. And that was always a challenge. It was much easier to get them to like me and to trust me than it was my client, I have to admit.
That is true. And I'm not certain if it was you or if it's another defense attorney who told me about all of the thought process that goes into building that relationship, if you will, with the jury or with the judge, and that trust factor so that it does become transferable. So much so that, you know, part of it is also optical theatrics, I like to call it, which is, you know, yes, you're right. Many jurors, no matter what they've said in voir dire, many of them consider the defendant guilty just by virtue of the fact that they're sitting there. And no matter how many times you tell them, they are cloaked in innocence until a determination has been made beyond a reasonable doubt that they are in fact guilty, and of what is also within the purview of the jury to determine. But in that, it also goes into like what you actually wear during trial. I don't know. Again, I don't know if it was you or someone else who said they would start off by wearing darker clothes.
Oh, that was beginning me.
And lighten it up.
I would wear my darkest suit, darkest tie on the beginning to show how serious the whole matter was. And then each day of the trial proceeded, I got lighter and lighter and lighter to show that the cloak of guilt has been removed from my client into the brightness of innocence.
And so every trial ends up with a white suit.
Well, yeah, not that bad. I wasn't suit. Colonel Sanders, but I would get close sometimes. Ooh, yeah,
that's hilarious. But yeah, or a seersucker. with a seersucker suit on. Like, my client is not guilty. Look at my suit.
Yeah, if I got to Matlock by the end of the case, I was good. That old Andy Griffith character that wore the same seersucker suit every trial.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Opening statements are so important, though. I think we would both agree. So many trial seminars that you and I have both gone to and taught, the overall perception is that after jury selection, the voir dire process, where attorneys get to ask questions of potential jurors and the judge as well, after the voir dire and after opening statement, study upon study has said that's where cases are won or lost. In that those first two components, voir dire and opening statement, you can lose a case and you can lose a jury, or you can win a case and at least win the attention of a jury. Would you agree with that?
You are absolutely correct. What I would say is, And I know to some litigators, this might even come across as shocking, but I would say that voir dire is even to some regard more important than opening statements. And the reason is because voir dire is the only time when the jurors can talk back to you. And you really get a chance to solidify that rapport by actually getting to know them and having a conversation with them. Everything else is more passive. Everything after that is them merely listening to you. And depending upon the court that you're in and the rules that are being recognized in that court, you may or may not even have an opportunity to take notes that you can refer back to personally later. Some judges don't permit that. I would permit note taking because I realized that
on the behalf of the jury.
Absolutely. I would permit jurors. I would actually provide jurors with fresh notepads for each new trial, as well as, you know, writing utensils, because I wanted them to. Now, there are some judges that will argue that this takes their attention away from the testimony or from the evidence, but I actually think it's the reverse. I personally have seen jurors literally sit there, listen to testimony, and they're writing notes. They're not conversing with each other and saying, hey, what did I miss or whatnot? They're not doing that. They are truly, truly engaged. And again, from the very first opportunity as a litigator that I have a chance to have a conversation with a juror, that is voir dire. Everything after that is them listening, them taking it in, and them filtering it through now, like you, what you just described is kind of that trust factor, right? The trust factor of, do I trust this lawyer? Do I trust this attorney? Do I trust what I'm hearing? And how am I interpreting this? Yeah, I heard the witness say this, but I heard the specific question asked this way. So do I believe the witness? Do I believe that they're being combative? Oh, wait a minute. They look like they're not, you know, trying to get along with my friend, the lawyer, who is not your friend, but is someone right that you've now been able to connect with because you trust them. And so you start looking at the case and you develop a perspective of the case, which is what every attorney wants you to do, right? They want you to develop the perspective of the case through the eyes of that attorney.
And you do that through questioning. You do it through one-on-one contact with jurors, if you can, obviously in the courtroom, one-on-one questioning of a juror. You do that as coming across as human, not being flippant about things, but also having a sense of humor.
Relatable. Being relatable
to jurors, so that you can then in closing argument bring up certain things that juror may have said during voir dire. Voir dire is critical. And when you put voir dire comes first, and then once a jury is selected, opening statements the next process. So those two go hand in glove, I think, in solidifying the relationship between the attorneys and by osmosis, perhaps, mm-hmm. the parties, you know, and the jury.
You build
that relationship. Now the challenge here, and I wanted to bring this up to you. The challenge is that according to the latest study, the adult attention span is 8.25 seconds.
So that means we lost our audience about 15 minutes ago.
Oh, by far. Now, if you're an older adult, as I am, and you aren't yet, if you're an older adult, your attention span expands to 47 seconds. But what that says, just like we've talked about YouTube videos and so forth, if you don't grab somebody immediately, you're not going to get them, and you're not going to get them back. You know, so not only is there this whole idea of building rapport, but you have to do it quickly, and
Absolutely.
You have to do it in a way that's dramatic enough to keep people's attention.
You are so right. Let me tell you, one of the things that I think is a really good, and this again is for prosecutors and even for defense attorneys, I think is a really, really good way to start an opening is with a powerful quote or something really shocking and compelling in the case itself. So, you know, let's say you had someone that says, "I'm going to slit your throat and feed you to the wolves." That's your first line, even before you even say your name. You start off the story with, "I'm going to slit your throat and feed you to the wolves."
It's like a journalism story. The inverted yes. pyramid, you put the most important thing first down to the least instead of building to a conclusion. Sorry to interrupt, but that's...
But you're absolutely right. And you kind of hide yourself a little bit behind that because you get to frame like what that statement is, who it came from, what the context was, what they're going to hear, how they're going to learn about all of this. And yeah, by the way, my name is so-and-so. I'm here to represent so-and-so. And this is what you're going to hear throughout this case. And if you think that was bad, here's what else you're going to hear. You're going to learn A, B, C, D, and E. And that, I think, again, like you said, is that pyramid. It helps to build it, but you now have a really captivated, not just a captive, but you have a captivated audience that is literally hanging on the next word that you'll say. Now, to your point earlier about the strategy of how a defense attorney might respond to that, if that were the prosecution's opening and whether or not they would give it either immediately following the state's opening or if they would wait until later, I think there are two schools of thought with that. First of all, I do agree with you that you know, again, if you have a dynamic and charismatic prosecutor who's literally got, you know, what you think is a really, really strong case, I don't think you wait until your case in chief, if you're the defense, for the jury or the judge to hear your voice for the first time. I think you need to be pushing back and you need to be countering that and maybe being a little more aggressive or as aggressive as you can very early and very often, quite frankly. But if you feel like your case has a fighting chance, that the defense for this is extremely strong, and by the way, maybe your prosecutor's a little boring and they are not charismatic and you're not hoping
like the original one in the Karen Reed case.
Right!
I got all kinds of guff for calling him oatmeal. But anyway, go ahead.
But or potted plant. But yes. if that is the kind of prosecutor that he is, what you're probably thinking in your mind as a defense attorney is just like the jury, I want to just forget everything this person said. I mean, yeah, they're laying out the evidence, but this is so boring. Then there actually is a strategy and there's a strategic reason to wait for the state to finish their case in chief and then to come in with your extremely high energy, dynamic fact, you know, roadmap of a opening and hit them with that right at the top of your case in chief. And the reason is because it's not hard to drown out what you just heard from a, you know, potentially boring prosecution, and you're using this as a way to infuse energy into your decision makers and to also help them forget about the droning sound of the lackluster prosecutor they just had to endure for however long.
All right. So as a defense attorney, you started out as prosecutor saying, what was your opening line about slitting throats? Give it to me again.
I'm going to slit your throat and feed you to the wolves.
So as a defense attorney, I would get up and say, just think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Have you ever been accused of something and you didn't do it? Or have you ever said something and had that comment taken out of context by a friend or a relative to a point where it has harmed you? My client, you're going to hear evidence, has said, I'm going to slit your throat and feed you to the wolves. But why did he say that? Did he say that because you had beat him up multiple times? Yeah, whatever. I'm extending it, but that's how I would counteract that.
Indeed.
And bring it back to the jury. So have you ever been accused of doing something that you didn't do?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, everybody has.
Who hasn't been? There's no one among us who hasn't.
Then they start thinking about that. Have you ever said something that was taken out of context that came back to hurt you at a later time? Sure, everybody's had that. Girlfriend, boyfriend, relative, boss, whatever.
Indeed.
Co-worker. And so, again, the defense is trying to make it relatable to the jury to take some of that sting away, you know, and then get into, if you can explain it away, you know, maybe the person was in self-defense or whatever the defense would be to a particular case. But you got to get the jury off of what the prosecutor said, the shock value, and back to internalizing, you know, maybe they've been falsely accused.
That's that relatability part, right? Because when you say, you know, have you ever had the experience of being accused of something that you didn't do? Have you ever had something taken out of context? Have you ever said something that you regret having said, but things went too far? Any of those things. And you know, the human psyche is immediately going through an entire laundry list.
They're going through their whole life laundry list.
But yeah, that was me. Oh, yeah, I remember that time, or that just happened to me yesterday. And these aren't questions that you have to ask during voir dire. These are things that you just know as part of the human experience that more likely than not, yeah, the vast majority, if not every single person in your jury and certainly your jurists, they're going to have had an experience like this. And the point is to do exactly what you said, which is to dull the impact of the prosecution's, you know, thunderous delivery that really says, hey, this is what the person said. They're going to say what they did. They're going to allege this was the outcome, but I need to give you a different perspective.
I had two prosecutors that I came up against routinely when I was a defense attorney, and one was bombastic. I mean, just everything was bigger than life and just over the top. And the other one was dull as dishwater.
Beats oatmeal, but okay.
But I had to adjust accordingly. The one that was bombastic, I had to tone myself down. I didn't want to match the bombacity, you know, if that's a word, but I needed to tone it down so that they thought that person was being extreme. The person who was dull as dishwater, I had to amp it up a little bit, you know. It those things that you do sometimes on the fly, sometimes you just have to know the personnel, but it's all part of crafting that statement and building that rapport.
And it's also what I like to call courtroom choreography.
I love that. I love that.
What you also have to do, yes, there are facts. Yes, there's the presentation of facts. Yes, there, you know, is a way to kind of make that and to conduct that presentation for the benefit of whoever your trier of fact is, jury or judge. But there is some choreography that needs to go into what that delivery looks like, because that's often just as important as the facts themselves.
Yeah. I'd love that term, your courtroom choreography.
Indeed.
I danced my life away.
Absolutely.
Many occasions.
Absolutely. And you know, just as jurists, we often have to hide our emotions and our responses because, my goodness, you may or may not expect certain answers or responses. I certainly had my fair share of those experiences with my own witnesses, or even with, you know, the defense witnesses. It was, you know, sometimes, especially if it was an unfavorable fact, right? Or if it was something that was just not going to be seen as a feather in their cap, but more like a dagger in their back. And it's the thing that you have to get out. It's the thing you cannot avoid. It is the thing you must address. My question to you is, do you do that first or do you do that last? I tend to get it out first because I don't want that to be the last thing the jury remembers.
Yeah, every study that I've read said that juries remember the last thing they hear more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's the law of primacy and recency, right?
anything that is negative, you want to get out early.
Yeah. So if I knew
you're going to hear my clients had a prior criminal record, he has. I just say that, but that doesn't mean that he did this particular crime.
You know what this reminds me of, and this is not a plug at all, but there is a movie called The Burial, and Jamie Foxx plays famous attorney Willie Gary, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with Willie Gary.
Yes,
but
yes.
The opening scene of The Burial, if you ever had a chance to watch it, I invite you to just watch the first 10 minutes, and you are welcome to turn the rest of the movie off, although it'll be to your detriment because it's theatrics all day long. And Willie Gary probably... Well, Jamie Foxx as Willie Gary probably does like the best job of courtroom choreography. You know, his client in this opening scene is a defendant. Well, actually, no, it's a civil case, believe it or not. And his client has been injured by a truck driver. And his client was actually he was drunk when he was driving. He was drunk. He had run a red light. He was... he actually hadn't run a red light. He was drunk. He was depressed. He was sad. He was not paying attention. And Jamie Foxx is telling the jury all of this stuff about his client. He said, you know, my client is terrible. My client is horrible. He's an alcoholic. He was drinking that day. He was, you know, X, Y, and Z. And he gets to the very end after he has all but literally maligned his client to this entire jury. And he said, but you know what? He had on that day, he had himself a green light. So, this whole story about how terrible his client is. And he said, but you know, on that day, you know what he had? He had himself a green light. It was the whole case. But I say that to say that's sometimes the situation that we're in when we really have to say, you know, this person is not good. Okay. Yes, you're going to hear they got a record. You're going to hear. And you know how many times as a prosecutor I had, you know, drug dealers as victims?
Yeah. You're not saying this person's a good person.
No.
You know? Just say this person didn't do this act. Now, as a judge, I want to jump in here. As a judge, one of the things that judges have to monitor in opening statements is that opening statements to a crafty lawyer can turn into closing arguments.
Yes,
in the sense that the attorney starts arguing the case as they perceive it. Opening statements should be, our evidence will show X, Y, Z. This witness will testify A, B, and C. You know, so it is what your evidence will show as opposed to arguing what it has shown, you know, and that's the biggest challenge for a judge is to keep attorneys on that track.
Oh, absolutely. And also to keep them from trying to give the jury any instructions on the law, whether it's in openings or in closings, but absolutely, you know, knowing where their lane is. You know, you can do a lot of right things in your opening statements, but you can do some wrong things in your opening statements as well. And as I said before, I usually would leave it to the prosecution to defend their own case unless an attorney is getting into my lane as a jurist. When you get to the point where you're trying in any way to give the jury any kind of instructions on the law, that's when I stop you. I expect the other part to be handled by the other attorneys.
We've got to let our listeners know. If you ever watch basketball games, there's fouling constantly. Mm-hmm. Just only a few fouls are actually called, but there's body contact, there's bumping, there's elbows, there's all kinds of activity to try to gain an advantage. Well, the same thing happens in trials. People push to the limit And sometimes they get called on it, and sometimes they don't. But the judge is the ultimate referee to determine whether or not it's appropriate. And you're right, if somebody gets into the judge's lane and starts making the call on their own, no, that's not, that doesn't happen.
Indeed. And I promise you, the offender, whether it's a pro se litigant or if it's an attorney, they don't usually have the sensibilities to stop themselves per se. And you can't count on the other side to stop them either. And so it really is the responsibility of the judge to kind of doggedly man that lane and to ensure that there's no encroachment into that area. You can give a lot of latitude, right? When you're giving an opening statement or even a closing argument, you know, you can, you know, offer up this framed scenario to the jurors. You've given them kind of this roadmap. That's pretty much, and in large part, the point of the opening is to give a roadmap and kind of tell the jurors where they're going to go on this trip or this journey with you, and to keep your word and actually take them on that journey using that roadmap. But that said, you need to stick to that. And that's your lane. That's where you're supposed to be. Because if you veer off, it should be within the purview of the judge or somebody else or the other attorney to kind of signal that it's inappropriate. And right. I would do that all the time. And I'd often, you know, if I needed to, I'd strike something from the record.
Yeah. Which is useless, but we do it just to make a point. Because once the jury's heard it, they've heard it. Okay, let's move on to closing arguments. Now, just so that the audience out there knows, closing arguments happen at the end of all of the testimony. So you've had jury selection, you've had opening statements, you've had all the testimony from the prosecution, whatever testimony the defense chooses to put on or not to put on. At the close of all of the evidence, then you have closing arguments. Mm-hmm. The prosecution gets two bites of the apple. They go first, they go last. Reason? Because they have the burden of proof in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt.
And it's not because anybody likes them more.
And right. Defense has one shot. Sometimes judges will put time limits on closing arguments. To me, as a judge, it depended on the attorneys. If I knew they rambled on ad nauseum, and would put the jury to sleep, I sometimes would give them time limits just to make the pain easier. but normally, you don't put time limits on closing arguments. And the length of the argument depends on the severity of the case and the length of the trial as well.
I'll tell you, as a trick I used to use just prior to closing arguments, no doubt there would be a motion to dismiss right before the close.
Outside
the presence of the jury. So the jury would be dismissed and there would no doubt be a motion. You'd ask if there are any more motions. You could almost always count on there being a motion to dismiss the charges at the conclusion of the defense's case in chief, even if they didn't put on a case in chief. And I would then address the motion, and immediately following, I would then address two things. If there's a jury, I'd address any corrections, amendments, addendums, or issues with the jury instructions. And then I would say, let's talk about closing arguments. How long do you need for closing arguments, or how long do you think you'll be? I don't want to impose time limits, but I do want to respect the jury's time. And if, you know, and I would leave it to the attorneys to actually tell me how long they believe they need it for closing arguments. And obviously for prosecutors, it would include their, what we call their opening close, and then their close, or their closing argument and their rebuttal, as you said. But I would say, hey, listen, you know, I want to be able to communicate to the jurors, or I want to be able to expect a reasonable period of time when this is going to wrap up. So if you think you're going to be here for 3 hours, you need to let me know so I can tell you, you only have 30 minutes. So because I'm not going to be here for 3 hours. But unless it's a really complex case and it requires going through a lot of evidence, then you may need a few days to get through a thorough closing argument, depending upon the complexity of the case. And, you know, with, you know, very complex cases going on, like the Karen Reed case we reviewed, and like currently you have the Puff Daddy case that's going on, it is entirely possible that those closing arguments in those cases could take several days to just complete closing arguments. And that's not unreasonable given the magnitude and complexity of the evidence that the jurors heard. But that said, if it's a more simple case, that's how I got a really good sense of what the jurors could expect and what I could expect as a judge. And again, reminding them that you can talk to them about the facts. I will be the only one to instruct them on the law. These are boundaries we don't cross. So let's get this understanding squared away before we get back on the record.
All right. So as the prosecutor, how did you structure your first argument and your second argument?
Well, I will tell you my closing argument, or my initial closing argument, was always a recap of the promises I had made, or the journey I was taking the jury on, or the evidence I had told them they would hear, and I would connect that to exactly what they did hear. That was also the purpose of my trial notebook, because I had it color-coded as well. So I would literally go through and I can check off every single time I knew an important fact or detail was actually achieved and who they heard it from. Because in closing, I would say, listen, I promised you at the beginning that this is this case, this is what would happen, and this is what you would hear, and I've kept that promise. You heard from so-and-so, they told you this. You heard from so-and-so, they told you this. You saw this. And so that is exactly what I told you you would see. And I would go through all of those elements, if you will, of all that connectivity, that connective tissue that I brought together. Now, again, I also, without beating a dead horse, I also knew that I would have, if I've got a particularly, you know, I don't know, morally challenged victim, or even a morally challenged witness, I knew that the defense was likely going to come back and beat that dead horse, if for no other reason than to challenge their credibility and to make them appear, or to kind of prop them up as someone who's untrustworthy. And so I told you I was going to tell you this. I would always say one of my favorite things to tell a jury when I had a less than desirable victim, but I still had a strong case, is I would talk to them about the importance of justice for everyone. And I would tell my jurors every time that we do not reserve justice for the perfect among us, because if we did, none of us would get justice. And that I would be very careful to really slowly let that sink in, because I wanted to remind my jurors that none of us were perfect. Everybody's got faults and flaws. And no matter what form they come in, you want somebody like me fighting to make sure you get justice, no matter how many flaws you have. But that said, and you chuckle, I remember a particular case where I had to do something similar. And just as I sat, the defense attorney rose to tell the jury how he had been struggling with this case all night, and he had been working on this case, and it really troubled him, and he'd been working so hard on his closing argument. And then he pulls out a cocktail napkin from the bar across the street from the courthouse that has all of his notes on it. I was just no more good. I was like, is that what a struggle looks like? Is that what it means to be up all night trying to pull this case together for your client? And it's like, yeah, had the name of the bar across the street on the flip side of the cocktail napkin. So we knew exactly where he had been writing his notes. It was just comedic to me. So I say, also be careful. If you're not going to write your closing and you're going to rely on notes, go ahead and splurge for the legal pad. It'll come in handy. And it's okay to not read it. I've seen instances where, you know, attorneys have literally read their entire closing argument jury.
And No.
Yeah, right. Please never do that. But you asked about the second closing, and my close would always be noteless, just as noteless as every other one. But you know what? It would be in direct response almost to whatever the defense said. Or if it's by chance something I may have forgotten in the opening close, I might weave it in, but I am listening intently. I'm probably not even going to object, but I am listening intently to every single thing the defense says during closing arguments, because I promise you, I am going to take it and I am going to nail them to it in the final close, because I get the last word and I'm going to make sure that they're going to eat every one of them.
So I would start out, given we have a shady victim, I would start off asking the jury a hypothetical question, and I'd say, you know, just think about how you make decisions in your life. You know, what kind of information do you need to buy a new home? You know, what kind of information do you need to send your son or daughter to a particular college? How much information do you gather to make the most important decisions in your life?
How do you decide if you're going to marry that joker?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you need to know?
Think about that, and now apply that to this case. Has the prosecution given you the same kind of information that you would require to make these decisions in your life? The answer is no. And then I'd go through the litany of why not.
I like that approach, though, because these are the most important of your affairs, and this is what we tell them.
Right, and that's the jury instruction, but I didn't say it's the jury instruction. I said in them making their decision, they needed to have that in mind. You know, and if I could get by with it, and I'd say, and the judge will instruct you that, you know, you are to consider a reasonable doubt as, you know, a doubt that you would have in making most important of your personal affairs decisions.
But you're so right. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but when I don't know that I've heard anyone kind of put it the way you just did in identifying those important life markers. If you think about, hey, you know, what information do you need to decide if you'll retire now or 5 years from now? What information do you need to decide, you know, what community you'll live in or what house you'll buy? What information do you need to decide what school you will send your child to for more education or
right.
not?
Right.
Those are all so very important, like
and I'm personal, and brings it right back inside
yes.
the juror. And then I would follow up by saying something. The information provided to you by victim X in the prosecution's case, would you rely on that kind of information to marry X or to buy that home? Then I bring it back to the evidence. You know, you start off bringing it into them personally, and then you bring it back to the evidence, and you go through the litany of evidence and why there's reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
The whole defense closing argument's based on reasonable doubt. It just has to be.
Indeed.
That's your shot with the jury is to raise reasonable doubt at least in one of the 12, so that you at least have a chance of getting a hung jury, if not a not guilty verdict.
And as a prosecutor, I think one of the best responses to that is in close, an attack of reasonableness. And I would start by telling a jury, you know what? Defense asked you some really important questions about what information you needed to make some of what would be perhaps some of the most important decisions you'd ever make in life. And we don't disagree. I think you do deserve that information. But at the same time, what they wanted you to believe is that you don't have what you're holding. Yeah. And you absolutely have it. Here's what you have. And I would tell them, he told you you didn't have this. Here's what you got. He told you you didn't have this. Here's what you got. You didn't have this. Here's what we told you.
Two other things I would add to a defense closing argument is I would make sure that the jury knew the difference between innocent and not guilty.
Oh, yes.
That, you know, you're not finding my client innocent. You know, my client may have done some bad things, didn't do what he's charged with doing, but may have done some bad things. So you can't just make him an angel. He's not innocent, but the government, the state, has not proven him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of each and every element of this offense. So I need to make sure that they know the difference between innocence and not guilty.
Indeed. And I think in those jurisdictions, in addition to that, in those jurisdictions where jurors are not tasked with sentencing or anything related right. thereto, that they need to be relieved of that that obligation to even consider it. And just be reminded that, listen, this is a step-by-step process. This is, the judge is going to tell you all the things you're duty-bound to consider. And punishment, penalty, sentencing, if that's not one of them, the judge is going to tell you that that's not one of them. And so aside from that, we, you know, you're going to be instructed to just focus on X, Y, and Z. And again, without telling them what the judge is going to say, and again, not veering off into the wrong lane, but just reminding jurors, because some of them do struggle, I believe, with that anxiety of, oh my gosh, this is going to result in, you know, this person, you know, having, you know, fill in the blank penalty. Well, that's not for you to consider. And it's not for you to worry about. We just have to take the first step, which is, as you said, is the person guilty or do you acquit them of this particular offense?
The other thing I would do is that I would always refer them back to voir dire, to promises they made me during voir dire. You promised that you would make your decision in this case based on your own judgment, your own personal judgment. Now, I only can talk to you once. The prosecution's going to have another chance of talking with you. When I'm finished here, I just sit down and I can say no more to you. But you promised me that you're going to use your own judgment. So when you hear the prosecutor talking about different things, I want you to use that judgment and raise questions in your mind. And if those questions are not satisfactorily answered, you've got to find my client not guilty. So,
yeah, that right there, while looking like Colonel Sanders, is probably that might swing some stuff. And you know, you raise a really good point, which we didn't get to, we probably won't, but I don't know if you've had the experience in trying a case which invited questions from the jury. I would actually, as a jurist, when I was on the bench, I would actually permit jurors to submit questions after witness testimony, and the defense and the prosecution had the opportunity to meet at sidebar, and we would review them. If they objected to those questions for some reason or another, I would vet those.
That's what I did as well.
They'd often agree on them.
they had to be in writing and mm-hmm. submitted to the court through the bailiff.
Yep.
And then go over them with attorneys, either at sidebar or out of the presence of the jury, and then
right.
come back.
Now, this isn't during deliberation. This is literally during the trial. So, yeah, that's
during
also why I thought note-taking was important, because that's where they get inspired by the questions.
Right. You know, we're out of time again.
Already. but this was such a fun discussion. I'm thinking, you know, boy, if we had been in a firm or, you know, in some kind of practice together, we could really be dangerous.
let me tell you, I would love to have been a defense attorney against you being prosecutor. That talk about a battle of wits. or
fun
maybe
indeed.
Nitwits. I'm not sure which, but
I don't know.
It would have been really, really fun.
You know what I appreciate is making friends. The defense bar, I have plenty of friends over there, so we never let it get personal either. So when it's over, we still meet up.
I was just going to say that there are some prosecutors that I, to this day, respect and are my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't take it personally. You respect people doing their job the best way they can possibly do it. And mm-hmm. then there are some real asses.
Indeed.
That you go, no, you know, whatever I could do to beat this creep, I will do.
Indeed. You know? There are some that are, you know, the poster child for being a jerk. So
you got it. Hey,
yeah.
How do people find us?
Hey, we look for you to reach out to us using some of the most popular podcast platforms and outlets, starting with NPR, National Public Radio, who we are extraordinarily proud to be a partner with and to offer this podcast on that platform. You can also find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any place else you get your favorite podcasts. We will be there. Just look for Next Witness, Please, and you will find Judge Tom and myself, because we will be continuing our endeavor and our commitment to decoding the legal process, because we genuinely believe you don't trust what you don't understand. And our goal is to help you understand this process more. And by virtue of that, you'll be able to trust us more.
Listen to this while you're listening to trials or following them in the news. There's several notable trials going on and several on the horizon. So, you know, check back with us. We have an archive on all of the podcast outlets. You can go back and you can listen to something that we may have done a few episodes ago and bring you current on something that you're witnessing in the news, and that's part of our mission as well. If you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can always shoot me an email. My address is Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, Hodson at ohio.edu. And if you have topics for us to cover, shoot those to us as well, and we'll put them on the list, and I'm sure we'll get to them in due course. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. And Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.